Not quite a decade ago, he was an architect of the surge, the military strategy that finally enabled the United States to stabilize Iraq. What is he advocating today? A plan to defeat, not to contain, but to defeat ISIS. General Jack Keane on Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Born in Manhattan, John M. Keane attended Fordham University, Western Kentucky University, and the Army War College. An Army paratrooper in Vietnam, General Keane led a distinguished career at which he finished as Vice Chief of Staff of the United States Army. Having retired from active duty in 2003, General Keane helped to shape a 2007 policy paper entitled Choosing Victory that served as the basis of the surge, President George W. Bush's new strategy in Iraq. Now chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, General Keane has been advocating the defeat, not the containment, but the defeat of ISIS. General Keane, welcome.
I was glad to be here.
Take us through the whole thing, beginning with the enemy, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or ISIS. 2014, it proclaims itself the center of a worldwide caliphate, claiming religious, political, and military authority over all the world's 1.6 billion Muslims. It now controls many of thousands of square miles in Iraq and Syria, containing a population, estimates are all over the place, by the way, but the population of something like 3 to 8 million. And although it may be medieval in outlook, it is totally modern in its use of technology, and we've seen them use social media to have horrible things such as beheadings and crucifixions go viral around the globe over and over. Where did these people come from?
Yeah, it's a great question, and sometimes we forget to understand what the genesis is. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was an organization that existed to a small degree before the war in Iraq in 2003, but it grew in scale largely because Americans were on the ground in Iraq. And the senior leadership of Al-Qaeda that was in Pakistan called for a holy war and declared the war in Iraq as the new front of the war against Westerners and America. So foreign fighters fell in on Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that began in 2003 and grew in scale and size. We had the wrong strategy for a number of years. You pointed out that President Bush changed that strategy. We were successful in defeating that organization. I was helping David Petraeus on during those 2 years in 7 and 8 with multiple trips to Iraq. And I saw the intercepts that they showed me written by Al-Qaeda in Iraq to leadership back in Pakistan saying this war is over, we've lost it. Those are my words, but it's a paraphrase of what they said in multiple intercepts that we had. So that was essentially over for them around 2008. Security.
So the surge worked.
We defeated Al-Qaeda. We defeated the Sunni insurgency. And then in 2008, for the first time ever, we defeated an Iranian-backed proxy, which was the Iraqi Shia militia, which they had trained in Iran. That's not the subject of our discussion, but it is noteworthy. So by 2009, 2010, Iraq was essentially stable. But what happened is that when we pulled, and I don't want to relitigate all of this, but when we pulled out.
I just want your thinking.
We pulled out politically and militarily from Iraq. Politically, it began in 2009. Militarily, it ended in 2011 when we pulled our troops out. Al-Qaeda began to emerge, actually a little bit before that. And they had several hundred fighters. And they were operating in the shadows, not consequential, to be quite frank about it, and something that the Iraqi government and its security force would likely be able to cope with. We always said that we're not here to deal with a car bomb that goes off episodically. We're here to deal with a sustained threat against the regime that was going to topple the government.
Right.
And there was evidence of that clearly in 2006. So here these several hundred fighters were operating in the shadows, and because of Syria, the opportunity that Syria offered them, the civil war that began in Syria, al-Baghdadi, now the leader of ISIS, not called ISIS, it's still al-Qaeda in Iraq, seizes that opportunity. It is the most strategic decision that Baghdadi makes. It's critical what happens after. He goes into Syria, occupies some towns, and establishes what becomes a safe haven and a sanctuary, calls for foreign fighters to join him. He started out with several hundred Iraqis, essentially, and grew to 30 to 40,000 from 2012, is when he made this move, to 2014. We were tracking in that the Institute for the Study of War almost on a weekly basis. Many people in government were not paying much attention, and certainly there was no reason for the media to be paying much attention. And then in 2014, this what was several hundred terrorist organization operating in small cells grew into a terrorist army.
Now in Syria, based in Syria. Essentially in Syria.
And they actually were, in a sense, had military bases of their own that they occupied there. They began a recruiting and training campaign. They gathered logistics. They had money. And that force began an invasion of Iraq in January of 2014 in Fallujah. The Euphrates River Valley goes all the way up into northern Syria. They just came down the Euphrates River Valley and seized the town of Fallujah, shocked everybody. And then 6 months later, as we all know, in June, they came in and took the town of Mosul in northern Iraq, very consequential, second largest city in Iraq, and that got everybody's attention. So that's where they came from. And now they have morphed into the most successful terrorist organization that's ever been created in modern times. They are defending Iraq and Syria. They've expanded into 9 affiliates, with 3 more destined to be approved. They go through a formal documentation process and a legal
process. Oh,
they
do. Process, so there's yes. there is serious command and control here. These nine affiliates are run by the center.
They don't run them day to day, but they guide them in terms of what's most important. And they provide resources for them, not to all of them, but to some of them, and they clearly have a priority on which ones are most important.
General, while we're still in the background, I want to ask the place of the Syrian civil war here again very, very quickly. We've got 4.5 years of civil war in Syria. President Assad's Shia Alawite sect is attempting to sustain its control over a Sunni majority. 250,000 people killed, some 8 million people displaced. And that is simply, ISIS simply takes advantage of that, or is ISIS involved in the civil, is ISIS a party in the civil war? This gets complicated, so as simply as possible, but what do we need to understand about any relationship between ISIS and the civil war in Syria?
ISIS' singular motivation was to take advantage of the civil war, establish a safe haven and a sanctuary.
They're parasites, and then, they're users.
And have territorial control. And as a result of that, they have a swath of territory in Syria and in Iraq, which makes them very different from any other organization, but also makes them very vulnerable because they have to defend that territory. They have conducted some limited operations against the Assad regime. It's not their major effort. It's clearly a secondary effort. But it is important to them because they would welcome the Assad regime to topple. They know that the major contestant, if something like that took place, would be Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda organization operating in Syria against the Assad regime, and the Syrian moderates, most of whom, but not all, are backed by the United States. Mm-hmm. Those are the contenders against the Assad regime. And ISIS would want to have a seat at that table. So as a result of that, they do some limited operations against the regime. But their primary focus is expanding into the affiliates and creating a worldwide following using the internet to do that.
They claim they want to reestablish the ancient caliphate, authority over 1.6 billion Muslims worldwide. And you believe them? They really do mean that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've got to come to grips with, we've been discounting radical Islam from the first World Trade Center bombing in New York City in 1993, the 2 embassies that we lost in 98, and the USS Cole, and then certainly 9/11 got our attention finally. And even as we started to have some success against al-Qaeda, I think many people just again began to discount this movement and how many people are committed to it and how serious they are. It's sort of, we dealt with ideologies in the past and we have a tendency to discount them. When Nazism was rising in the 30s, the world leaders at the time, weary of World War I, and they heard this pollution, this ideological pollution coming about white supremacism and Nazism, and they discounted it, and they, oh, we can't be serious.
Hitler's just a crank. He can't mean that.
He can't really mean that.
Right.
And guess what happened? The Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Belgium, and that got all of our attention, certainly France for sure. And then the world had to deal with that reality. Communism, the same thing. They were going to establish a model state called Russia, and the world would come to them,
right,
and this ideology would spread around the world. We have a tendency to discount these lofty interpretations of ideals that men or other leaders represent. And the reality is, yes, they're dead serious. They are absolutely.
So the lesson of history: take the bad guys at their word.
You have
take
and,
them
and
seriously.
They publish extraordinary documents. There's never been an organization quite like them.
Right.
It's in color, and they publish it like an annual report of a major corporation. And they lay out what their intent is. And so they're very clear about what they're attempting to do. Now, whether they can achieve that or not, in my judgment, they're destined to fail, but we have to get organized.
So
so
that's their long-term plan, mm-hmm, and they're serious about it. What are the medium-term objectives here? Where do they want to be in 3 years, say?
Well,
what are their next few moves?
In the near term, the near term largely concerns the region itself. They want to expand the caliphate that they've established, which they now call the Islamic State, with a portion of Iraq and Syria. That would probably mean, for sure, Jordan, and continue that expansion. That's the near term.
By the way, do we have any evidence that in the land they already control, there's any popular support at all? Do we know if they have any support among the people? Or is that simply unknowable?
The only support that they had is when they came into Iraq, because Prime Minister Maliki, the former Prime Minister of Iraq, had so disenfranchised so many of the Sunnis, Sunni tribes that is. When they came in, some of them supported them. And some of that support is still there. But a lot of that is reconcilable, because we have reconciled them once before, as we did so successfully,
right,
in 2007. It was called the Sons of Iraq, the Anbar Awakening. So that's fertile ground. They are aligned with, some of those tribes are aligned with them because of near-term objectives only. They know that they cannot live under the boot of ISIS, that it's not their values, it's not their customs. They don't want their grandchildren growing up underneath them, as they did not want the Al-Qaeda. So they have accepted them for that reason only. But most of the people that are under their boot, they terrorize and intimidate them, and they force behavior on them that is an anathema to what they were experiencing
so
before.
So is that a kind of self-limiting problem they face? Even as they're trying to expand, they have to hold a population down. And
right,
that takes manpower and surveillance, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And one of the things we have to be careful, because if we believe that eventually ISIS will wear out its welcome and people will revolt against it, certainly they will do some of that. But that strategy alone will not defeat ISIS.
Okay. Now we come to Jack Keane and how you beat them. I'm just going to take, if I may, a few quotations of yours from recent television appearances and recent writings and ask you to elaborate on them. And I'm setting aside the political question of how you muster the will in this town to get anything. Set that aside. For this moment, I'm just asking, how do you do it? What are the military questions you have to answer? You said this in a recent appearance on Fox, quote, "We have to unleash a devastating, unrelenting air campaign," close quote. What form does that take? Why does it have to be us?
Yeah. Well, to deal with defeating ISIS, I mean, you need a comprehensive response to it. First of all, the first thing we have to get organized to do is to defeat the idea. And the reality is, post 9/11, one of the commission's recommendation was we should form a global alliance to deal with radical Islam, because it may not just be the Al-Qaeda. And that turned out to be prophetic, as we now understand. We've never done that. And we cannot defeat the idea from the Department of State, which we're trying to do. We need people in the region, national leaders, we need Muslim clerics to push against this ideology and what's wrong with it, and to push their own ideology and why it's right. And that has to be a comprehensive approach to it. So the ideology is important and puts us into a generational struggle to deal with that. The second thing we must do.
So we should be, somebody at state, maybe they should run it out of the White House, somebody pretty high up should be making a business of identifying good guys in the region and doing all we can to support them, give them a platform, give them a voice. Is that the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. We have leaders in the region who already want to do this. The King of Jordan, Egypt, al-Sisi has written, his head cleric has written two op-eds in a Wall Street Journal pushing back on this ideology. So al-Sisi understands that. He's appealed to his clerics. He said, look, you cannot sit on your hands here. We have got to take this on. This is a political and theological ideology, and it's largely religious. And you have to attack it on that basis. You can't stand back from it and pretend it's not. So we need, and the leaders of the UAE, and I think we can persuade also the new leadership in Saudi Arabia, particularly what the Deputy Crown Prince represents, Mohammed bin Salman, who's in his early 30s and is a visionary. He understands this and also knows that we have to push against it. Now, that's very interesting because they have a history of Wahhabism and Salafism inside of Saudi Arabia, which has been a contributor and has had a relationship with the radical part of Islam. But there, yes, we have to help the leaders in the region get themselves organized against this. Saudi Arabia has recognized this themselves and has brought together 34 nations to start to do this. Now, whether that's going to have real substance to or not, I don't know. But the United States has sort of got a hands-off approach to it, and that's really unfortunate. We should be all in, helping support them and get the Europeans behind them because we all have a vested interest. The second thing we need to do is destroy the safe haven. We learned
this whole region or the bases
where
in Syria?
They are, where what they're defending. The biggest lesson from 9/11, in my judgment, was that Al Qaeda had a safe haven throughout the 90s in Afghanistan, and despite blowing up two of our embassies in Africa and dropping, putting a hole in the USS Cole and killing Navy sailors, we didn't take that safe haven away from them. That huge mistake. That brought us 9/11. They have a safe haven, and we have got to destroy it. From a military perspective, that is doable, and we have to craft the proper plans to do that. And the third thing is...
Can I just... Does that not involve huge risk to this to civilians? If we go in with an air campaign, don't they just retreat into the cities?
Well, let me come back to that.
Okay.
And the third thing is we have to organize against the affiliates and marginalize them. And that means we have to have an alliance. See, it's not enough, and my point to you is, and to our audience, you have to approach this problem comprehensively so that you're pushing against radical Islam. They feel pressure wherever they're at. And there are nations of the world that can come together to deal with this, much as we did to deal with communism. We came together in political and military alliances because we were dealing with an enemy that any one country facing by themselves would be threatened by, but collectively, we would have the judgment and the resources to deal with it. We should take a page out of that and get ourselves organized. Not something the United States necessarily has to lead, but something we can help get organized because our leadership is important. Get back to the military thing, destroy safe haven. We have to take Iraq and Syria away from them. Now, the fact that they own it makes them different. The fact that they have to defend it makes them vulnerable. At the end of the day, this is like...
We know where they are.
Yeah, this is like taking Korea away. This is like taking Germany away from the Nazis. This is territory that they must defend. So how best do we do that? So you had mentioned an air campaign. Well, if we're going to use air power, we have to use it in a devastating, effective fashion. Now, that we know how to use air power and minimize civilian loss of life, not just because of our technology, precision-guided munitions, which we have, but also because of our value system. But we have refused to put air controllers on the ground to make that air campaign more effective. That's a mistake. One of the things we did from the very beginning, I think, it's kind of unprecedented in U.S. military planning campaigns, and that is when the president in the Obama White House made its mind that they wanted to do something about ISIS. And this was after the Americans were beheaded, certainly, in the summer of 2014. He made that decision. But as opposed to going to the Pentagon and saying, look, I want to defeat ISIS, Give me some plans to do that.
Give me a plan. Figure it out.
That's not what happened. And usually that is what happens. And we come back in with some options, and we show the president what the risk is with each associated option.
Right.
And then we would probably tell him what a favorite option is that we have. But what he said right from the beginning, okay, I want to destroy ISIS, but look it, I want no boots on the ground. And he said, I don't want any civilian casualties from an air campaign. And pushback, Mr. President, that's impossible. You're always going to have some casualties, because the problem is the enemy lives in among a civilian population. They're not out on some remote piece of land fighting each other. So the reality is, he said no civilian casualties. The example he provided was the Israelis in Gaza. I don't want civilian casualties. So we imposed on the military a stringent system, which translate into what technical military terms, rules of engagement, to try to get no civilian casualties. As a result of it, our air campaign has not been effective, because if we have a target, by the time we get it cleared, the guy can drive next to a building and we won't go after that target.
What did the president mean by providing the example of Israel and Gaza? Because in Gaza, all the, as best I could read the situation, even as a military matter, all they can do is contain the bad guys, precisely because they've imposed on themselves such stringent rules of engagement. And of course, Gaza's densely crowded. What is it, over 1 million people in that little strip of land? But what you're asking for is merely management, problem management, not solving it. Certainly not taking territory away from an enemy. So what did he have in mind when he said,
the way the Israelis handled Gaza? The civilian casualties were too high, and what Hamas did, of course,
He said he wanted to avoid Israel.
He wanted to avoid casualties that Israel was causing.
I see.
And Hamas, their operation centers, everything they do where they store stuff, is in among civilian.
Intentionally, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Intentionally, right. So that was sort of the point. But we have taken that to an extreme. Now, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, through Secretary Carter, is trying to release some of those restrictions, but they're still not quite what they should be. Then on the ground, we know you cannot defeat somebody who's holding territory simply by using bombs. That has never worked. So we need an effective ground force to do that. We're not going to have an effective ground force in Iraq until we are able to put together thousands of Sunni tribal militia to be able to not only take back the territory that ISIS holds in Iraq, but also hold that territory. The Iraqi army, largely Shia, while they can participate in that, will never be able to hold the territory. The Kurds have reclaimed the territory that they've lost. They have little interest in Sunni tribal lands. They'll participate a little bit in the operation in Mosul, but they won't hold it.
Is the Kurdish region more or less safe? They're good fighters. They've got it under control.
They're not going to help outside.
They've got their own.
They'll do a little bit to create an acceptable security buffer for themselves.
I see.
But they're not going to do anything more than that. So it really comes down to Sunnis and how we can strengthen them. And I have said in congressional testimony that the amount of trainers and advisors we're providing are nowhere near what the requirement is. We need thousands of them, not hundreds, to get the throughput that you need. And also make the commitment to the Sunnis. That would send a large statement to them that we're going to be there for them, and then we're going to give them the arms and equipment. The other thing, the political dimension of this inside Iraq is as important as the military dimension. Our strategic objective inside of Iraq should be to reduce the Iranian influence that has been growing. And because the administration has been so preoccupied with the nuclear deal with the Iranians, they just haven't spent the time necessary to move the new government, which we all welcome in the name of Abadi, who took Maliki's place, to move him to begin to enfranchise the Sunnis, to bring them back into the fold. That is an absolute, an essential requirement if we're going to be successful. And Kerry should be in and out of that place on a regular basis. I just did testimony with Ryan Crocker, our most esteemed ambassador in the Middle East. We both made the same recommendation, except I said dispatch Crocker, Ambassador Crocker, put him in here full time. And of course, he had a different idea, but he's a remarkable diplomat. And he had the same conclusion that we have got to move the ball politically in Iraq if we're going to get the military outcome that we want, which is different.
General, you know what you're talking about. You do have a comprehensive plan. You even know the personnel you'd call on. You used Ambassador Crocker jokingly, but only half jokingly. You know the people in this town. And you've been talking about this for years, making perfect sense for years. What's the holdup here? Again, I'm quoting you on an appearance. This is late last year. The president talks about strategic patience. Throw that out the window. This is Jack Keane talking. We cannot wait to defeat ISIS. The more time we take, the more killing takes place. We've got to get on with this thing. Close quote. Why haven't we gotten on with this thing? Now I'm asking about the politics in this town.
Well, we're dealing actually with the president's foreign policy and his strategic sense of how he looks at the world. And I think President Obama, now that we've been with him for all these years, looks at the world differently than every president I'm aware of post-World War II, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And he sees the United States not playing the traditional leadership role that we did in the world to help stabilize and secure the world and help create prosperity. And as a result of that, he's pulled back the United States. And I'm not talking about a muscular military foreign policy that he accuses the Bush administration.
You're not saying a second war in Iraq.
I'm not talking about, you know, using bullets first, but I am talking about using American leadership. And he pulled back from the Middle East rather dramatically, and we've all seen it. He abandoned Mubarak when the Arab Spring began. He abandoned the new leadership that was elected in Libya after we deposed Gaddafi. The only thing they wanted was security assistance, and we wouldn't do it. He abandoned Iraq, and I think that is well documented. The Syrian moderates came into this town over multiple years asking for assistance. We said
against
no.
Against Assad.
Yes. Clinton, his Secretary of State, Panetta, his Secretary of Defense, Petraeus, his Director of the CIA, and Dempsey, the Chairman, all went to the White House on a Friday afternoon in the summer of 2012. This is after repeated refusals to help the moderates, when there was still an opportunity to turn the tide against Assad. And the president said no. And that is not an unsophisticated national security team. I would suggest they were four people who sort of knew what they were doing and felt that this was an acceptable risk, Mr. President. Now, why did the president not do that? I'm left only speculate, but my speculation is this. I think he didn't want to do anything that would interfere with the nuclear deal that was being negotiated, and he did not want to antagonize the Iranians who were propping up the Assad regime by conducting and supporting a military campaign that would damage Assad and possibly push him out of power. He did not want that. He knew the Iranians didn't want that. That is the only logical explanation I can come to why this behavior by a president and actually disagreeing with a very competent national security team. So his behavior in the Middle East, in pulling back from these countries and not being involved, has turned the Middle East over to who? One, the Iranians, and they've achieved more domination than they've had in the past. Two, the radical Islamists. They're on the rise. It's obvious that they're on the rise. And I think that the decision the president made with ISIS, he didn't tell us what this decision is. He told us that he wants to destroy ISIS, then he changed it to defeat, a better term. But he didn't tell us that he's not going to take the actions himself to do that he's really going to contain ISIS, and he's going to pass that responsibility to the next administration. Because while I described what we could do in Syria, and we don't have enough time to get into all the details of it, but in Iraq, I described it in Iraq, he has no plan whatsoever to defeat ISIS in Syria, which is where their primary safe haven is. He's passing that to the next administration to take care of it.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, or president's advocate, for just a moment here. Let me quote you, General Keane, in the Wall Street Journal, again last year. Why stick our noses in now? The answer is that Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and others will not stop at Iraq and Syria. Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Turkey, Egypt, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates and others will be next, close quote. Those are big countries with big populations, and a couple of the countries you named there, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are very, very rich. They are sitting on top of enormous amounts of cash. Why can't they handle the problem themselves? That's an ordinary impulse to say, why us? Why not them?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, we have failed states in the Middle East. We have authoritarian regimes that are desperately in need of political reform, social justice, and increased economic opportunity. Some of these regimes are run by family monarchies, and they're our allies. And there's certainly an accountability and a responsibility that they have to their own people and their civil society that to a certain degree has helped generate the kind of distrust that many young men feel, and they have joined a radical Islamic movement. It's not the basis for it, but it's contributed to it. And you can say, well, look, the Middle East isn't our problem.
Right.
Let's just leave it alone. It's too hard. The culture is very different. Everything about it is hard. The best thing to do is try to contain it as best we can, and let's just stay out of it. And I'm sympathetic to that, except that's the way everybody thought in 1938, and look what it got us. Does anybody believe that if we pull away from the Middle East, or just take minimum amount, which is what we're doing now, to contain it, that radical Islam will stop there? That was my point. They're going to keep coming. They are dedicated and committed to what they're trying to achieve. So they're not going to stop. They would just take that as weakness and keep coming. The barbarism and the killing will go on. Now, why the United States? Because those countries need our leadership. They don't need our guns as much. They need our leadership. We do matter in the world. And the other thing is, we do know how to fight wars better than any other country in the world. Why? Because we've been involved in post-World War II, helping to stabilize the world. And we've created the best military in the world, and it is a thinking military. It's very adaptable and flexible. It has its faults, to be sure, and we can go find one on any given day.
The United States military is more capable today than when you were a paratrooper in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah, much more so, yes, yeah, sure. And it's one of the things that we did is we made it a volunteer force, so the people who came into it want to be there, and you professionalize the force a lot more, and you can put more investment into that force.
One more question then about that very force. So we've got the Pentagon. Not quite a decade ago, you and Fred Kagan and a few others were involved in helping to develop the strategy of the surge, and as is well known, you got it to the president effectively through a kind of side channel. The vice president's involved in this, but it gets to the president from outside the Pentagon. Not the Pentagon. Now here we are 10 years later, and Jack Keane is the one who has a comprehensive plan for defeating ISIS. I'm sure you have friends, I'm sure you have sympathizers across the river in the Pentagon, but I guess what I'm asking is the proper role of the Pentagon. If you've got a president who seems to be so abdicated, who's not even asking the right questions, I don't see anybody resigning. I don't see generals stepping down and writing books to advocate what they believe, what some of them surely must believe needs to be done. We've got 1.4 million men and women in uniform, and these guys in the Middle East are 30,000 or 40,000. So you're on the Joint Chiefs. Suppose you're on the Joint Chiefs today and didn't retire in 2000. What's the proper role? You see things that the president is refusing to act on. What is the proper role of brass across the river today?
Well, you're getting into the culture of the military a little bit. I'm convinced that there are leaders in the Pentagon, you know, who do not disagree with the president's strategy and have tried to advocate a different strategy. And those arguments were lost a long time ago. And what changes we make now is on the margin. So you see 50 special forces going into Syria, 100 going over here. Those are marginal changes. They're not comprehensive changes that we need. I guarantee you, we get a new president, Democrat or Republican, in 2017, when we have one, we will see a change in terms of what it's going to take to defeat ISIS. It'll be somewhat different than what we're doing right now. So is your question that those leaders should quit because the president has not agreed with them?
He's younger than you, but you know him. H.R. McMaster wrote this wonderful book about Vietnam, mm-hmm. in which he argued The top guys put up with too much. There should have been more. Somebody should have resigned. Somebody should have gone public.
I think it was true, given the scale of what was taking place. The other thing that's operating in the military, and I'm not being apologetic for it, but in the military, loyalty is very important. And if you're going to, and it's really what binds the institution together, because we ask people to do things that they really don't want to do. And so if we have military leaders quitting every time somebody above them is asking them to do something that they don't want to do, what kind of message are we sending? So the culture of the military is, look, here's what I think we should do. The boss above them, in this case, commander-in-chief, tells them, no, I don't want to do that. This is what we're going to do. Okay, we sort of ruck it up and execute that mission to the best of our ability.
Because you have men and women underneath and if you, you expect them to do the
same. So
the
culture is always going to be, got it, boss, and then suck it up and get on with it.
Got it.
I mean, and because that's what we're asking our guys and gals to do.
Got it. General, last question. Jack Keane, speaking about ISIS late last year, quote, "We're only talking about 30,000 to 40,000 guys lightly armed. We can take their territory away from them, and we can crush them." You want to stand by that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not suggesting that we're doing this with the 82nd Airborne Division. I am suggesting we help organize the theater to do it and that they bear the brunt of it. But that's going to take leadership.
And what's the likelihood that the next president, whoever he or she is going to provide that
leadership? Oh, it's going to be job one. It'll be right there.
Democrat. Or Republican. Whoever comes after Obama is going to see this.
Yeah, absolutely.
General Jack Keane, thank you very much.
Enjoyed it very much.
For Uncommon Knowledge on the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.